misconceptions are so prominent. Mm-hmm. And some of the churches go to great lengths to hire somebody to come in and give lectures. Mm-hmm. Can I just give you an interesting observation?
Okay.
One time, it's been a few years ago, that one of the women's clubs, and I don't know which they are, but they're made up of all the some of the higher class of people, ladies in town, and they meet regularly, and they have speakers come in and talk on different subjects. And one time, they asked me to come and tell about the early days of the LDS Church in this valley. And I went willingly, and it was to last about 30 minutes. Well, it generated enough interest among these ladies that it went on for over an hour and a half. And at the close of it, I asked them if I could ask them a question. And I asked this question. I says, why are there so many churches that are so prejudiced against the Mormon Church or the LDS Church? And you'd be surprised the response that I got. And one lady particularly, she said, they're jealous of you. They're jealous of your beautiful big buildings. They're jealous of your welfare program.
I'm not surprised at that.
And they're jealous of the program that you have for your young people. And this was from their people themselves, from other churches.
Yeah. That's very plausible. You don't have to be poor to be jealous.
No. But, and I think that same vein kind of run through, and that's caused some of the contention.
Has some of this reaction that you've noted throughout your life strengthened your faith?
Oh, it just reassured me of, well, we have nothing to hide.
Yeah.
Our teachings, we have these 60,000 missionaries in the out all over the world at all time out telling people. I went on a mission. I went to Texas for 2 years.
When you were in your 20s?
When I was 19 and 20, 21. And I'm willing to tell anybody about the church that wants to know about it. Because, we feel that we have something to offer everybody. And I personally am very proud to be a member.
I can tell that. Let's hop back in time. You talked about the little old schoolhouse that you went to.
Mm-hmm.
Was this in Imbler?
Yes.
Yes. Now, what was it called?
It was just Imbler School.
Okay.
And it's still there.
Which one is that?
The red brick schoolhouse. And they've added on to it. It's right in the, on just west of the highway. And it's still there.
Oh, I've been to that school area. It's a two-story building.
Yes, red brick.
Right, and then there's that Ware Hall?
There used to be Wade Hall.
Wade, yes.
And
yes.
They built that gym when I was little.
They
build on new grade schools and everything.
So why do you call that two-story building it's not little, obviously, but it's old in that it was built probably in 1890 or so?
Is that interesting? I don't know exactly the year
that the school that I taught in Freewater was built in about 1890, and it's a very similar look.
That's an interesting question, because that's something that I have never been told, but it would be in that area.
What specific memories do you have of how it looked on the inside when you were a student there?
They were 8 big classrooms.
And with high ceilings.
And the downstairs.
High ceilings.
Pardon?
High ceilings.
Yes.
Yes.
The 4 classrooms down in the first floor was grade school, mm-hmm. 2 grades in each room, mm-hmm. and it was true with the classrooms upstairs. We had assembly hall where we all assembled, and then we the other was classrooms. And it outside of having a library and a coat closet, that's all there was.
Yeah.
The restrooms were in the basement.
I suppose you had the desks that are on metal runners.
The desks were individuals.
Oh, they were?
They were individuals. You could write your desk. You had a place to write, and your back served the part for the desk behind you,
well,
or vice versa.
Well, weren't they connected together by runners below?
Now there was... Maybe they were put on a one before.
Yeah.
They could have been on a one before.
The janitors liked that because they could clean the room easier that way.
Well,
they
I don't
shoot,
remember.
Shoot the mop right down the aisles.
Maybe that was true.
Yes.
I hadn't thought about that.
When I started teaching 5th grade, those are the kinds of desks that my children had.
Uh-huh.
And then the little inkwell with the steel nib pen.
Yeah, and
yes.
then when they used to take the girls... braided deal and stick it in the
sure.
I think that that was more talk than do.
Well, most boys did it if they had a chance.
Yeah.
Can you remember a typical schedule for a day?
Well, we started school at 9, mm-hmm. and we go to 12. We have a recess between 9 and 12, mm-hmm. which we all look forward to.
Yeah.
And we had a 1 hour noon, back to school and go. And then all your athletic activities and things was done after school, your practice of
sure.
basketball or baseball.
That hasn't changed a lot.
No.
How do you remember that you had when you were in elementary school carried on instruction? What did they do?
Well, they were pretty firm. They had discipline.
Right. But how did they actually teach reading, arithmetic, science, penmanship, and all the other subjects that you had?
Well, we were given reading assignments. We did reading out loud before the class.
In a book like McGuffey's Reader?
That sounds familiar. Yeah. But there was one teaching tool that we had in the grade school that I've never seen anyplace else. But we had big sandboxes.
Yes, you mentioned that in the other interview. Yeah.
And I think that was one of the most effective tools that I remember.
I think that was an idea that came from German educators.
But I certainly remember mine. And we went to great lengths to decorate or to build a community or whatever it was in those sandboxes. And I remember particularly of Holland when they built the water. We'd put blue paper underneath glass and use it for water. We build the windmills and the dikes and all those things, and I've never forgotten.
That made geography real.
Yeah.
We would call it now hands-on learning.
Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Well,
it's kind of gone out of style, but in the 1930s it was very popular.
But why has it gone out?
Oh, education is fraught with fads, as you know, and it's hard to say that there's any one reason for moving from one teaching method to another. Somebody or some group of people get an idea that this would be a better way, or that there would be a better way of teaching students something or other, and if they have access to teachers' colleges and other places of influence, they get that idea going, and then it sweeps the whole educational field. You mentioned moving away from phonics. That's what happened.
You know,
it wasn't that phonics was a bad idea necessarily, but another idea became more popular because there were people promoting it.
Yeah. Well, do you know the interesting thing of it is, to this day, I still use the phonics I learned in my first
cycle. Of course, it's a necessary part of beginning instruction in reading. I'm a professional educator, so I know that it can easily be exaggerated as the way to learn to read, because all it does is make you aware of the connections between these little squiggles on a piece of paper and the sounds that we have in our normal speech. And of course you have to know what the connection is in order to read.
Yeah.
But that's just the starting point. There are so many levels of reading beyond that it certainly isn't the whole answer. Do you recall that the teacher, for instance in reading, might have said, now I want you to read this page and answer some questions, comprehension questions, and then you'd recite your answers? Was that how the teacher was helping you to learn to read?
I think there was some of that, especially with history and and things like that.
Read the chapter and answer the questions.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we did have tests.
Now in eighth grade, you had state tests, didn't you? In all subjects?
On state tests?
State. Coming from the state office in Salem?
You know, I don't remember. No. I won't say we didn't, but I don't recall.
Gertie Hibbert told me about them.
Did
she? And Verna Courtwright gave me some examples of tests from 1915.
Of course, I was
a little later
there by 50.
Yeah. Maybe you didn't have those.
But you know, there was an interesting thing that we had one county superintendent of schools, and he traveled and visited all of our schools.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have buildings full of people doing what he did.
Yes. Yeah, I know the complaints there. Just one other subject. You mentioned seeing the Indians a number of times when they would come over here for the rendezvous. But you didn't say very much about how they looked, how they dressed, what their faces looked like, or how they talked. Do you have some memories of those things?
They didn't wear feathers. When they come over here to do salmon fishing, they were just dressed like any, more or less like everybody else. And I'd seen them up on the Catherine Creek catching salmon, spearing, because they could do that at their own will.
Now, by this time, of course, they were confined to the reservation for the most part, weren't they?
Well, yeah, they had reservation, but they still had rights to come up here, fishing rights and hunting rights, and they still have that. And I've seen Indians in recent years come and hunt for elk.
There have been many observations that once the Indians were put forcibly on the reservations, their spirits were broken.
I believe
that. They didn't have as much self-respect as they'd had before.
I believe that.
Were you aware of that when you looked at them or talked to them?
Well, I would have no way of judging that, because they come through necessity. Like the Indians would come and camp up above Mount Glen, out where Gertie and them lived. They camped up in the timber.
Mm-hmm.
They would come and stay through the whole huckleberry season and pick huckleberries.
Yeah.
And
you didn't get close enough to them or talk with them enough to get a sense of how they felt spiritually?
I never really visited with those women, because I was just a kid myself. And but they were very diligent in what they were doing. Another interesting thing with the Indians, all through my young life, the Indians would come from the reservations over and come to our place and see if we had any deer skins or elk skin. And if
and they would tan them.
And they would take them and tan them for ham.
Yeah.
And they did a beautiful job. Oh, how I've longed. I just wish that they had a program like that now.
Were you hearing stories from any of the adults when you were quite young about the relationship between Native Americans and white people?
If the truth, I think a lot of the white people kind of looked down on the Indians, sad as it may be.
Why do you think that might have been?
Well, they didn't speak, a lot of them didn't speak English. And a lot of them lived in substandard situation. I don't know. I've never had that feeling towards the Indian. Because for us, the Indian people are a very special people because of our belief and knowledge about where they come from. We know where their ancestors come from and how they got here to the American continent. And so the Indians have been special to us. And our church has done a lot of work and are still doing a lot of work to help Indian people.
So, apparently you were aware that a number of white people in this area probably were prejudiced against Indians.
I think they could have been. And, of course, the last war, the major battle between the Indians and the white people were fought right out here close to Mount Glen. You knew that.
The so-called Battle of the Grand Ronde.
I guess that's...
Yeah. There are many versions of that.
Yeah.
Yes. Were you also aware of the fact that people in the Grand Ronde Valley had prejudice about people with black skin or Chinese people?
I think so. And that's sad.
Did you hear any talk about that?
Oh, we used to talk about Chinatown.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't necessarily mean prejudice. What was associated with the talk about Chinatown? That these are...
You know, they were pretty well all gone when I grew up. But they worked them. The white, or the Americans took advantage of the Chinese people. They just worked them like animals.
The railroad probably wouldn't have been built without... They're having done that.
Yeah. But I don't know how to explain it. We had a Chinese noodle place when we were kids.
Yeah, I've heard about that many times.
Yeah. But as far as we didn't have many black people here in our community.
Well, there might have been more than you knew.
It could have been.
I've interviewed three black people.
Is that right?
Yes. And gotten quite a bit of background. They were, perhaps like the LDS community, fairly tight. Mm-hmm. They reinforced each other, living just on the north side of the tracks.
Yeah.
The people I've interviewed didn't speak about painful experiences, but they were certainly aware
that there was
discrimination.
Well, they were certainly in the minority.
Oh, yes.
Now, CIE had a lot of association down in Texas with that prejudice and with black people. Because when I was there, their laws said the black people goes to the back of the bus. Yes. And I witnessed that.
Oh, yes.
Interesting thing. When I learned very early on down in Texas that I never told anybody much when my birthday was. And I found out that my birthday is the same day that the black people were freed down there. And that was their day.
Emancipation Day?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. and I didn't know that when I first went down. Uh-huh.
Were you born in
1919.
Yeah. Okay. And where were you born?
At Imbler.
At Imbler. So, that was very soon after your parents arrived.
Well, they arrived at the turn of about the turn of the century.
Oh, well, that's
and my mother's family moved to Imbler, and my father's family moved to Mount Glen. They started.
Uh-huh. Gertie told me something about the LDS group that was at Mount Glen.
Yeah. That,
do you have any other particular observations about that community? Was it special in any way?
Well, there was land available to be bought. And my grandfather bought a goodly share of the land that was in Mount Glen. Mm-hmm. And then...
He was a Waite?
No, he was a Whiting.
A Whiting? Oh, yes, a Whiting.
Mm-hmm.
A connection with Lee Flower.
Yeah.
He's from a Whiting clan.
Yeah, and Perry. There was my grandfather Perry was one of the... bought a lot of the land down there.
And how did the Waites come into it?
The Waites come in through the Whitings and the Perry family. They married.
Through marriage, yeah.
Married it.
About Mount Glen School for a minute. I thought that I had fairly accurate that it was built in the first place by LDS members.
Probably it was, but I can't confirm that.
When do you think it probably was built?
I know that my father, he was about 15 or 16 years old when they first moved there. And he went to what was called the Moss Chapel mm-hmm. School over on the Hunter Lane.
Yeah, I know about that.
But I don't. He never. I remember him telling about going to school there. But I don't remember him telling much about that other school.
Okay. Do you think that if there were a connection between building the school and the LDS members out there, that there'd be any records we could find?
I wonder if it'd be in the school, county school.
Well. I have on microfilm some of the more recent records from Mount Glen School.
Is that right?
Dorothy Voorhees was the...
Dorothy Voorhees, I know.
Yeah.
Went to school.
She made sure that when the records from the small schools came in to LeGrand, they weren't destroyed before being microfilmed.
Oh.
So I have borrowed some of those from the school office. But for Mount Glen School, I was particularly interested in Mount Glen School. They don't seem to go back much farther than the 30s.
Is that right?
And I think the school is older than that.
Oh, it must have been. But it must not have been in existence when my dad went to school at the turn of the century, because surely he would have walked across the street to go to school mm-hmm. rather than to walk a mile and a half.
Yeah. Well, from this picture that I showed you in Gertie's transcript here, it was certainly in existence in the early 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't tell from that picture that's in that little booklet just how new it is.
Uh-huh.
Although if you look at the building now, you can pretty well see that there was an anteroom, maybe 6 feet wide, built on across the front of the school.
Across the front?
Yeah. It moved the school out a little closer to the road. And you can see two periods of construction there.
If you would have said that was in the back, I'd have said they put a woodshed on.
No, there was a separate woodshed.
Was there?
Yeah. I know that's so. Two outhouses.
Yeah.
Gertie told me about them.
Now, they've been long gone.
If I do research on the school in order to get it on the historic records for how that school came to be.
Have you ever learned anything about the Dry Creek School?
Yes.
They're having their reunion this week, I think. Mm.
I know Marshall Kilby quite well, and he owns it now.
Is that right? Oh, I didn't know who owned it, but my sister-in-law taught school out there back in the 30s.
Hmm. Is she still alive?
No. No, but she taught there.
You mentioned Jim Jarvis, the shop teacher.
Joe Jarvis.
Joe Jarvis at Imbler, and you say he's still living.
Yes.
How's his memory?
I'm not sure. I think he has a bit of Alzheimer's, but the retirement center down there.
Grand Rock Retirement Center?
No.
Wildflower. Road, Wildflower. Would he be in his 90s?
Pardon?
Would he be in his 90s?
Oh, I'm sure he is, yep. Yeah. Because he taught me in high school, and 5 or 10 years old.
I would think so, yeah.
But he had a great impact on my life.